One sins into the ear of a stranger. Georgie cleared her throat, trying to get the huskiness out of her voice. With forced lightness, she said, "What's the problem with your sister?" Mr. Van Dyvel took her cue, saying with an expression of mock distress,
"There isn't any. That's the problem. She's very correct."
Georgie couldn't help laughing.
"And your cousin?"
Mr. Van Dyvel's lips creased in a smile so indulgent it made Georgie feel almost jealous.
"Is anything but correct. She tried to elope with an actor when she was 17. The family caught her and brought her back. She wasn't repentant. She was furious."
17. The same age Georgie had been when she had staged her own elopement of sorts. But she hadn't run away with a man. She had run from one.
"You sound like you admire her."
Mr. Van Dyvel glanced through the thick panes of the window, a faraway expression in his eyes.
"I've always wanted to be as strong as Anne."
His eyes came back to Georgie's, rueful, resigned.
"I wouldn't know how to begin, though."
"You could always elope with an actress."
She'd spoken without thinking. Hastily, Georgie said,
"I didn't mean... never mind."
Mr. Van Dyvel politely ignored her confusion, pretending to consider the notion.
"It's not a terrible idea. At least it would stop my mother trying to marry me off to the daughters of her friends. Do you have an actress to recommend?"
Was he flirting? Georgie hoped not. Despite herself, she'd been enjoying their conversation. It would be disappointing to find Mr. Van Dyvel like the others, just angling for one thing. Georgie shrugged.
"I'd suggest Kitty, but she's holding out for a title."
"And what about you, Miss Evans?"
"Georgie."
In her topsy-turvy world, to be on first-name terms felt somehow safer than being a miss. It reminded her, as the bard would say, feelingly what she was. A survivor, outside the social pale.
"I'm not looking for a prince or a baronet."
"What about a mere mister?"
Georgie stabbed her fork into her pie.
"Not until man is made of some other matter than earth."
Mr. Van Dyvel raised a brow.
"Much ado?" "It is much ado."
"About something," said Georgie.
There were times when it was best to be blunt.
"I'm not looking for a protector."
"What are you looking for?"
"A bit of peace, a place she could call her own." Unbidden, the image came to her of Lacey Abbey, the broken cloisters laced about with thick summer growth, the heady scent of primroses and honeysuckle, the whisper of Queen Anne's lace against the folds of her dress. In memory, those summers seemed to last forever, all the boredom and dissent leached away by longing. She wanted that back, the sunlight on the water, the lazy song of the birds, the blackberries ripe on the branch. She wanted Lacey Abbey as it had been, and could never be to her again.
"Another drink,"
said Georgie, and twisted to catch Bert the barman's eye.
"Now, tell me more about your cousin Anne and her actor."
New York, 1899, January.
"Extra! Mind how you go, lady!
Boy, hey you, get out of the street!"
The streetcar driver rang his bell, scattering a ragged band of newsboys as it clanged by on its tracks. Janie's nose tingled with the smell of burned pretzel, roasting chestnuts, and the inevitable presence of horse manure, faint now in the stinging cold. It was a familiar backdrop to the less familiar sense of ink and paper, the shouts of the newsboys, the clamor of traffic, the rumble of wheels and printing presses buried in basements beneath the headquarters of the Tribune, the Sun, the Journal, the Times, the World, each racing the other to produce the biggest headline, the most sensational story. Right now, Bay's and Annabelle's deaths were that story. Janie could see it shouting out from the sandwich boards, above the fold on the papers being parceled out to the newsies. "Where is Annabelle Van Dyvel?
Murdered socialite's body still missing. Keeping her veil close about her face, Janie yanked her skirts out of the way of an inquisitive horse, skirting a small ragged band of boys. She shouldn't be out and about at all. The rules governing mourning were strict. In 3 weeks, she might accept condolence calls. In 6 months, she might call informally on friends, lightening her mourning from black to violet. But what rules applied to this situation? What was the rule when there was no body to bury? When instead of the muffled knocker enforcing silence, the bereaved household was riven with the cries of the press? In a world gone mad, the proprieties lost their importance. The world building was easy enough to find, even in the midst of such bustle. The rusticated facade dominated the street, but it was the dome that set it apart, flaming even in the weak winter sun, stretching higher than the spire of Trinity Church. It was something well out of the human scale, this monument to the news of the world. Or at least, thought Janie tartly, the gossip of the world. The building, with its echoes of the Renaissance, made promises that the institution itself failed to keep. It was grander inside than she had imagined, the elaborate ironwork of the staircase more suited to a palace than a printing house. The air was thick with smoke, cigar smoke, pipe smoke, smoke from the equipment below, and the floor rumbled and rattled beneath her feet. Everyone seemed to know where they were going in this entirely masculine world, clustered in small chattering groups, striding importantly to and fro.
"Can I help you, miss?"
A man broke off from his group and slouched over, trailing cigar ash. Janie spoke without thinking.
"Is the building quite safe?"
The man gave a bark of a laugh.
"Huh, that's just the presses, miss. There's enough steel in these walls to hold up half of Manhattan."
He removed the cigar from between his lips, held it out, and eyed her lazily.
"You looking for someone?"
"Yes,"
said Janie, and then more definitely,
"Yes, I'm looking for a reporter, a Mr. Burke."
"Come for the reward?"
He jerked a finger towards a gilded cage that was spewing forth men in battered hats and warm mufflers.
"Newsroom, 12th floor."
Janie would have thanked him, but he was already turning away, absorbed back into his conversation, a conversation in which she could hear her own name, Vandyval. Might he have... No, no one knew her here. There were benefits to being nondescript. She'd never had her engraved portrait in the papers. Her clothes were good, but not showy. There was no one to guess at her for what she was. And even if there were, what did it matter now? She had spent her life in terror of saying the wrong thing, wearing the wrong gloves, showing a fraction too much ankle. The relentless abjuration to be a lady, behave like a Vandyval, whatever that was supposed to mean. But all that paled to insignificance now, seemed small and petty against the drama playing out in the papers, the memory of Bay, golden and fallen. The gilded cage of the elevator jerked and swayed as it rose in the air. The dial on top jerked ever upwards. 6, higher than the top of her mother's house. 8, higher than Grant's tomb. Up, up, up in the sky, away from the known world, the brownstones that clung close to the pavement, the long skirts that trailed on the ground. Janie heard the sound of the newsroom before the elevator doors opened, a sound like a locomotive, the rattle of hundreds of typewriters, the shrill of a telephone, male voices raised to carry over the din. The elevator man had to ask her whether she meant to take another trip, before Janie, with a murmured apology, gathered up her skirts and hurried belatedly into the Tower of Babel. The room was large, larger than Mrs. Astor's ballroom, but it seemed small, crammed as it was with roll-top desks jammed together any which way, creating a crazy labyrinth of winding paths. Around the walls, placards shouted their messages in large letters. "Accuracy, accuracy, accuracy," read one, and "The color, the facts, the color," another. Rather more color than facts, Janie would have said. But there was an undeniable energy to the room, the clacking typewriters, the shouting voices, that put energy into her step and color in her cheek. The room was heaving with men, the air ripe with the smell of tobacco, sweat, and yesterday's dinner. Janie had never seen a man in his shirt and suspenders before, not even her father or brother. But here, jackets had been dropped over the backs of chairs, sleeves rolled up over forearms. Hats lay discarded on desks and dangled from hooks. She ought, she supposed, to be intimidated by such a palpably masculine environment. But something about it reminded her of her girls' club, the charity for working-class girls at which she volunteered 2 mornings a week, or sometimes more when she was feeling particularly low. Nothing here was for show or display. They all were what they were, pounding away at typewriter keys, holding the phone receiver to a crumpled shirt front as they looked up and shouted something across the room. It felt, thought Janie, like being at the edge of a beehive. There was something very impressive about all that concentrated activity. It did rather put a damper on her grand plan, though. Janie had imagined the newsroom as a series of offices with glass doors, doors which could be closed. She had envisioned herself sweeping mysteriously into Mr. Burke's office, a woman of the world in her black veil. A few murmured words, and she would be in the reporter's own private sanctum. Mr. Burke might not even be here. He might, at this very moment, be in her own kitchen. Perhaps, thought Janie Riley, she ought to have stayed there and waited for him to come to her. A man sat at a raised desk by the elevators. From the fact that he bellowed more loudly and more frequently than the others, Janie presumed that he must occupy some position of authority. She moved quickly to intercept the balding man in the gold-rimmed glasses.
"Pardon me, sir."
"Do any of you layabouts have any copy?"
he shouted, before looking impatiently at Janie.
"If you're looking for the residences, you're on the wrong floor."
"I've come to see Mr. Burke," said Janie, keeping her voice low, "about a confidential matter."
In stentorian tones, the editor bellowed,
"Jimmy! Lady to see you!"
And the entire newsroom paused in their efforts to inspect this new diversion.
"Hey, boys, Jimmy's got a girl!"
someone shouted. Another head popped up, shiny with hair cream.
"Lady, if you'd like to do better."
Janie took a half step back.
"If he's not here, I can always come back another time."
"Burke!"
shouted the editor again, and from somewhere in the middle of the scrum, a tall form unfolded himself and began weaving his way through the aisles, replying easily to the banter that accompanied his progress.
"Chief? Miss..."
His eyes narrowed as he recognized her through the flimsy stuff of her veil. He recovered with practiced ease, feigning ignorance with such skill that Janie might have believed him herself if she hadn't known better.
"May I help you, miss?"
What was it the man downstairs had said?
"I've come about the reward," said Janie hastily.
It was the wrong thing to have said. A dozen ears pricked up. Even the shrilling of the phones didn't seem to distract the reporters, who had all turned to her like sharks scenting blood.
"What did you see?
Was it intact?
Have you got pictures?"
Mr. Burke cupped Janie's elbow with exaggerated gentility, but Janie could feel the warning pinch of his fingers as he steered her towards the elevator.
"Now, now, gentlemen, you know the rules. This is my story."
Mr. Burke paused only to snatch up a coat and hat, talking all the while.
"And it's probably nothing more than an old boot. What was it last time, 2 sticks and a head of cabbage?
The elevator doors jerked closed on the sound of laughter and retorts. Mr. Burke shrugged into his coat, wrapping a muffler around his neck.
"If we want to speak in private, we'll have to go outside."
Dropping his voice, he added,
"Don't tell me you're really here for the reward."
The contempt in his voice was bracing. Janie straightened. Her height might be a disadvantage in a ballroom, but she was grateful for every inch of it here.
"I might be if I knew what it was," she said coolly.
Mr. Burke gave a bark of laughter.
"That's rich. But then I suppose your sort never miss the chance of adding to your coffers, do you?"
"My sort?"
Janie had to keep her voice to a whisper for the sake of the elevator man.
You mean human beings? Your paper wouldn't offer rewards if they didn't believe them an incentive.
Touché, Miss... Miss? Drawled Mr. Burke. But Janie didn't feel as though she had won anything.
The elevator decanted them into the crowded lobby.
If not the chance of lucre, what brings you to my humble place of business?
The pursuit of truth.
The words came out sounding impossibly priggish. Janie ducked her head as they exited the building into the full force of the wind. Breathlessly, she said,
That is what you claim to seek, isn't it?
You sound as though you doubt it.
Janie gestured helplessly towards the newsies marching up and down the street.
Wife's affair turns to double murder. Vandyval driven to it, say friends.
Can you blame me?
Mr. Burke's hand tightened on her elbow as a streetcar went clanging past.
That's the journal, not the world.
Is there any difference?
Yes, their circulation is higher.
His dry tone almost surprised Janie into a laugh.
If you think so poorly of my profession, why are you here?
Now was the time for her pretty speech, the one she had practiced before her mirror last night. Instead, Janie heard herself saying,
Because I need information, and you claim to purvey it.
There it is again, that word claim.
Mr. Burke waved to the policeman regulating traffic. It was rather miraculous the way the traffic parted at his call. Mr. Burke took her elbow and led her past the pawing horses and impatient drivers, nodding his thanks to the policeman.
Is it our inability to know the world that you doubt, or simply my morals?
She hadn't expected this sort of resistance, or if she were being honest, that he would be so well-spoken.
You can't expect me to think highly of a man who obtains entry into my kitchen under false pretenses, she said apologetically.
Would you have admitted me under my real ones?
That's not the point.
Isn't it just? If you want the fruits of my labor, you can't be squeamish about the means.
That depends on the ends, doesn't it?
At Mr. Burke's raised brow, Janie hurried on.
I don't mean to sound Machiavellian about it, but if there were an injustice being committed and one might use one's skills to stop it...
Ah,
said Mr. Burke, his steps slowing as they reached the plaza in front of the pale bulk of City Hall.
So if it's for the purpose of selling papers, it's immoral, but if it's to prevent injustice, all's fair.
He'd twisted her words, pushed them out of all meaning. But...
In essence, yes, said Janie.
They slowed to a stop by the entrance to City Hall Park. Mr. Burke's voice dropped, his eyes fastened intimately on hers.
Do you know something that makes you believe an injustice is being committed, Miss Vandyval?
For a moment, Janie teetered on the edge of telling him what she knew. But what was it, really? A name, half-heard, that might not even be a name.
George.
Janie tucked her gloved hands into her sleeves and walked briskly towards the fountain at the center of the park.
My knowledge of my brother's character.
The branches above them were sere and bare. In the summer it would be a leafy profusion, a bit of green in the heart of the city. But now the park seemed small and scraggy, the fountain in the middle weathered, the basin cracked and dry.
Character, repeated Mr. Burke. If that's the only reason you've dragged me into the elements, you might have stayed by your warm hearth.
Do you doubt my knowledge of my brother?
If I had a penny for every time someone told me, Little Johnny's a good boy, he would never do that.
Janie winced at Mr. Burke's falsetto, deliberately grating. Dropping his voice, he said flatly,
Character isn't written on a man's face, Miss Vandyval, or a woman's.
Without its usual sprays of water, the fountain seemed plain and bare. Even the gilded finials on the lampposts had lost their luster.
You think me deluded?
Mr. Burke tucked his hands in his pockets and looked down at her.
You're grieving, he said gruffly. It takes people different ways.
If he had been flippant, if he had twisted words into knots, Janie might have taken her defeat and gone about her business. But his reluctant kindness,
The condescension of his kindness infuriated her.
"That," she said tartly, "is precisely what the constable in Cold Spring said when I told him I had seen Annabelle in the water."
She waited a moment for that to sink in before turning on her heel.
"I know perfectly well what I saw and what my brother was. It's only on the stage, Mr. Burke, that mourning makes men mad."
She'd expected him to follow her, but he didn't. Instead, she heard the hollow sound of gloved hands clapping. Slowly, she turned and found Mr. Burke planted where he was, applauding her as he might an act at the circus.
"Well played, Miss Van Dyvel. May I say that you've missed your calling? You would have been a great success on the stage."
It wasn't, Janie suspected, meant as a compliment, but she couldn't help but be tickled all the same. It was rather refreshing to be treated as a woman of parts, a woman with secrets and mysteries, not just poor Janie, who couldn't catch or keep.
"It's not an act, Mr. Burke. I don't believe my brother killed his wife. If I were to sit back and allow verdict to be passed by the laziness of the police and the rapaciousness of the press, I would be doing him a gross injustice."
Mr. Burke folded his arms across his chest, but his expression was serious now, his attention caught.
"Isn't this a conversation you should be having with the police?"
"Why, so they can offer me brandy and send me home? They didn't believe me when... We both know the police follow the press, not the other way around."
"That's a great compliment, Miss Van Dyvel."
"It wasn't meant as one."
With nothing to lose, it was easy to speak her mind.
"With great power comes..."
"Great responsibility," Mr. Burke finished for her. "You do me too much credit, Miss Van Dyvel. I'm just a hack with ink-stained fingers."
Sensing weakness, Janie pressed forward.
"If the world were to raise doubt as to the commission of the crime, the police would be forced to follow suit."
"Is that what you want? A goad for the police?"
"Yes,"
Janie lied, although she wasn't entirely sure what she wanted. To know that something was being done, that Bay wasn't being tried solely in the court of rumor.
"If there is anything you might have discovered in the course of your investigation that might lead to doubt, that might raise other avenues of inquiry, I'll pay you."
Mr. Burke's expressive features hardened like ice over stone.
"To publish misinformation?"
"No."
Janie was appalled by his misapprehension.
"To learn the truth, to discover what really happened. I wouldn't want to spread a lie."
Mr. Burke eyed her skeptically, as though she were a piece of dodgy fish at the seaport.
"What if the truth is just as unpalatable as the rumor?"
The papers were saying that her brother had killed his wife and himself.
"Nothing could be as unpalatable as the rumor," said Janie firmly.
"Don't tempt fate, Miss Van Dyvel," said Mr. Burke grimly. "You might not like what it throws at you."
Something in his tone made the skin on Janie's neck prickle.
"What is it? What do you know?"
The sun had come out behind a cloud, with the pitiless brightness of January creating a nimbus around Mr. Burke's head and throwing his face into darkness.
"What would you say if I told you that Annabelle Lacey died in 1891?
Janie could feel the cold creeping through the wool of her coat.
"Are you mocking me, Mr. Burke? Annabelle couldn't... She wasn't. I saw her last week."
The blinding light made rainbows around Mr. Burke's face. Janie had to squint to see him.
"I misspoke. Let me rephrase that. Annabelle Lacey was presumed to have died in 1891.
Janie shook her head.
"You must be mistaken or misinformed. Annabelle married my brother in 1894. She held a ball..."
Her voice caught, but she soldiered on.
"She held a ball last week."
"Dead women hold no balls?"
Mr. Burke looked at her with something like smugness. Janie didn't like it.
"Annabelle Lacey disappeared from her home in Lincolnshire in the spring of 1891. It's a matter of record. The housekeeper found a shoe beside the bank of the river and a hair ribbon caught on a twig."
A shoe, lying on its side, melting snow creating a dark stain on the pale satin. A scarf, spangled with jewels, floating on the water.
Janie blinked again, banishing the images.
No, that was last week, not 8 years ago.
Would you like to read the telegram from my colleague at the Lincolnshire Standard? Miss Lacey's cousin, Mr. Lacey, went to some effort to have her declared dead. The local coroner apparently refused to sanction an inquest on the ground of insufficient evidence.
Mr. Burke folded his arms across his chest, his eyes on Janie's face.
Do you still want to know the truth, whatever the costs, Miss Van Dyvel?
Janie eyed him warily.
How did you learn all this?
Mr. Burke bent and picked up a fallen twig from the rim of the fountain, snapping off the branches one by one.
The telegraph is a remarkable thing, isn't it? It stretches clear across the Atlantic.
It was strange to think of those wires clicking and clicking, noon and night, carrying secrets from one end of the world to the other, turning the Atlantic into a fish pond, the globe into something one could fit inside one's pocket. She had known Annabel for 5 years, and yet Mr. Burke, if he was indeed speaking the truth, knew more of Annabel's past in one exchange of the telegraph than Janie had learned in 5 years. Mr. Burke might be lying. He might have fabricated it all out of thin air in an attempt to scare her back to the serenity of the drawing room.
Serenity? Ha!
Janie lifted her chin.
Was there anything else?
Mr. Burke looked at her sideways, a long, appraising look. After a moment, he said,
"It takes 7 years in England for a missing person to be deemed deceased. In 1898, Mr. Lacey applied again to have his cousin's death made official. Something about an inheritance, I gather."
His voice was carefully bland.
One can only imagine his surprise when he was told that she was alive, married, and living in America.
They paused in front of the statue of Nathan Hale. Someone had left a wreath on the pedestal. The garland was wilted, the ribbon frayed. Janie stared at the frostbitten flowers.
Annabel never spoke about her life in England.
Not even at the beginning, that first summer in Newport, when all the clucking matrons and disappointed debutantes had tried to draw her out, making pointed comments about her aristocratic connections. Annabel had merely smiled and changed the subject, quietly regal in a way that put the petty jealousies of others to scorn.
Janie had taken it as a sign of good breeding.
But what if it was something more? Mr. Burke clasped his hands behind his back, seeming to scrutinize Mr. Hale.
So you have two possibilities. Either Annabel Lacey died and the woman you knew as Annabel Lacey was an impostor, or Annabel Lacey, for reasons best known to herself, found it expedient to disappear, until she married your brother.
Janie looked away from Nathan Hale's incorruptible face into that of the man beside her. It was, she thought, an interesting face, all long, lean lines and unexpected angles. Secrets were written in the hollows of those cheeks, in the long, flexible line of his lips, his own and those of others. And Janie realized for the first time the magnitude of what she was taking on, the cost that might come of bearing the secrets of others.
"Well," said Mr. Burke, "have you heard enough?"
Above her, Nathan Hale gazed off into the clouds, scorning her weakness. Here was a man who hadn't folded in the face of danger. He had been executed here, on this spot, just a little more than a century before, giving his life so that a principle might stand.
"No," said Janie crisply. "My offer stands."
Mr. Burke raised a brow.
"Money for information?"
Janie nodded.
"What if,"
said Mr. Burke, his eyes fixed on Janie's,
"money isn't what I want?"
He was trying to scare her. She knew that. But she couldn't quite keep her voice as steady as she would have liked as she asked,
"What do you want, Mr. Burke?"
Mr. Burke straightened.
"Information," he said crisply. You might call it a window into your world.
Janie could have kicked him.
Isn't the kitchen door enough for you?
Mr. Burke smiled dangerously. Don't worry. I don't intend to sully the premises. One can only learn so much below stairs. It's not every day one has access to the daughter of the house.
He was trying to provoke her again.
Well, Miss Van Dyvel, do you accept my terms?
Janie wondered if this was how Faust had felt when he'd summoned Mephistopheles. Somehow these pacts ceased to seem like such a good idea once the devil was driving the bargain.
Yes, on one condition.
Only one? Said Mr. Burke. You surprise me.
Janie refused to be goaded.
If we are to work together, I will need your pledge of honesty. No lies, no omissions, no half-truths.
Mr. Burke gave a short bark of a laugh.
You don't ask for much, do you? Only the moon.
When Janie didn't budge, he said softly,
What of you, Miss Van Dyvel? Will you give the same to me?
The golden dome of the world loomed behind them, a reminder that any careless word might be printed tens of thousands of times over, projected to everyone with the 3 cents to buy the evening edition.
I will deal fairly with you if you deal fairly with me, said Janie.
And then, before she could think better of it,
Is Katie your cousin?
A look of reluctant admiration crossed Mr. Burke's face.
No.
There was something reassuring about that blunt admission. Or it might just be, Janie admitted to herself, that she wanted to be reassured. The wind had risen, shaking the bare branches above their heads, making Janie's veil flutter wildly. The same wind made Mr. Burke's coat flap around his legs, but he stood solid all the same, providing a wind block of sorts. Janie looked up at him.
Well then,
she said.
Well then.
Mr. Burke held out a gloved hand.
Let the games begin.
Janie surrendered her hand into his grasp, expecting a crushing clasp. Instead, he bowed over her hand with exaggerated care. His fingers on hers were delicate but firm. Janie could feel the tingle of his touch through the leather of her gloves. Nerves, that was all. Nerves at the impropriety of what she was undertaking.
One more question,
Janie said at random, seizing on the first thing to come to mind.
Yes?
Mr. Burke's hand still held hers. Quickly, Janie said,
What was the reward? The one I was meant to come to claim?
Mr. Burke released her hand, taking a step back.
Et tu, Brute? You put honesty to the test quickly enough.
The sun had gone back behind the cloud, and the sky was gray and cold, heavy with the threat of snow.
It wasn't meant as a test.
Katie had been a test. This was just a question.
I assume I could discover the answer myself by purchasing a paper.
Mr. Burke gave a curt nod.
The world is offering $500 to anyone who can find Annabel Van Dyvel's body.
There was something rather chilling about the image, the woman she had known reduced to a commodity, sought after by bounty hunters.
Why didn't you say so?
Mr. Burke cast her an ironical look.
I suppose I was trying to spare your blushes.
Janie had had enough of being spared.
Don't.
In her most business-like voice, she said,
I work at the Girls' Club on Frankfurt Street Tuesday and Thursday mornings. You may send a message to me there if you have any news.
Not to the house?
Honesty for honesty. Janie lifted her eyes to meet his mocking gaze.
My mother and cousin know nothing of this. I would prefer...
To keep them in ignorance?
Mr. Burke appeared to be more amused than appalled.
What other secrets are you keeping, Miss Van Dyvel?
None that would be of any interest to you, said Janie. Good day, Mr. Burke. I will look for your note at Frankfurt Street.
As Janie hurried away in the gathering dusk, She could see them standing there still. Mr. Burke and Nathan Hale, both staring after her. Chapter 5. London, 1894. April. The American came to the stage door the next night, and the next after that.
"Don't tell me you're not sick of us,"
Georgie said, but there was no hiding the fact that she was pleased to see him.
"I've never seen Twelfth Night performed quite this way before," said Mr. Van Dyvel, keeping an admirably serious countenance.
"And never will again if you're lucky."
She'd meant it jokingly, but it was beginning to feel prophetic. They were well into April now, a time when patrons ought to have been thronging the seats, but they were playing to a largely empty house. Even more worryingly, Mr. Dunstan had made no noises about the next production. Usually Georgie dreaded the period between shows, weeks to manage on her meager savings. They were only paid for performances, not for rehearsals. But rehearsals meant pay to come. The rumor among the cast was that Mr. Dunstan intended to sell the theater, that the show was only dragging on pending negotiations.
"So you've made your plans," Kitty said when she saw Mr.
Van Dyvel at the theater again and again. It wasn't like that, but Georgie knew Kitty wouldn't believe her that their relationship consisted of nothing more than food and conversation. If she weren't so afraid of using the word, she might even call it friendship. At first, Georgie had been punctilious in accepting nothing, not even the cost of her port and lemon or a slice of meat pie. She'd had admirers before, if admirers they could be called, men who tried to follow her home, men who didn't take kindly to no as an answer. She'd learned quickly that some men believed the price of a meal entitled them to more. But Mr. Van Dyvel remained as correct in his behavior as though Georgie had been Miss Lacey of Lacey Abbey rather than Georgie Evans of the Alibaba. Being with him, even in the rude environs of the Feathers, Georgie felt the veneer of the past 3 years melting away, felt as though she were a girl fresh out of the schoolroom again, proud of her company manners. Which was ridiculous, of course. But it was pleasant to share a meal, to talk to someone who liked the same things she did, or the same things she had a lifetime ago. Bit by bit she had relaxed her own rules, and when Mr. Van Dyvel put coins on the table to pay for her meal, she didn't push them back at him. A meal at the Criterion may have excited expectations, but meat pie at the Feathers had an odd sort of safety to it. It was the same with the gifts Mr. Van Dyvel brought her. They were never the sort that could cause offense or rouse expectations. Kitty had wrinkled her nose at the basket of oranges fresh from the docks, but Georgie had felt a strange constriction in her chest at the sensation of the wrinkled rind against her fingers, the sharp scent of citrus as her nails dug into the flesh. There had always been an orange buried deep in the toe of her Christmas stocking. The Colonel had made a game of it, taking out the atlas from the library, charting the paths the fruit might have traveled.
"They smell like childhood to me,"
Mr. Van Dyvel confided as Georgie buried her head over the fruit, breathing in that half-forgotten scent.
"My father wasn't well, so when it was particularly miserable in New York, we would take the train all the way down to Florida, straight into the sunshine. Nothing ever tasted so good as that first orange right off the tree."
"He couldn't have brought you roses,"
said Kitty. But Georgie had slept with an orange beneath her pillow that night, and woken with tears on her cheeks. The next week it was a slim volume of poetry, Edgar Allan Poe.
"Don't tell me you've never read Annabel Lee. It is,"
he added, his eyes meeting hers over the red morocco cover,
"about an Annabel lost."
Georgie's fingers fumbled with the book, flipping it open to the first page, using it as a shield. It had his name on the flyleaf, Bayard Van Dyvel, with a coat of arms comprised of a rising sun, 3 acorns, 2 annoyed squirrels, and the motto Omnibus Effulgimus.
"What's this, then?"
she demanded. I can sing for you in Italian if you like, but Latin is Greek to me.
We shine for all, Mr. Van Dyvel translated. He looked at her thoughtfully, but to Georgie's relief dropped the topic of Annabel. His finger traced the rays of the sun, one by one.
It was a rather feudal situation in New York up until a few generations ago.
It's not any more?
They were at their usual table at the Feathers, where Mr. Van Dyvel was now tacitly recognized as belonging to Georgie. Georgie might have corrected them, but it saved Mr. Van Dyvel being bothered by the attentions of Long Mary or Leaky Sue, which she assured herself would have embarrassed him considerably.
Not in the same way. A fact my mother regrets bitterly. She's constantly trying to stop the incursions of the new people.
Mr. Van Dyvel thought about it for a moment, idly running his finger over the shape of the shield.
I don't believe she would have liked the old order, though. My father's parents lived almost entirely in their house in the country, among the tenants they thought of as their people. When I was a child, there were a few elderly farmers who still spoke Dutch, or a version of it. They would feed me doughnuts and fried apples.
It had been crumbly cheese and flat gingerbread biscuits for Miss Annabel when she'd ridden out on her pony, or sometimes a salty bite of stuffed chine or pork loaf, rural delicacies that weren't to be found in the Abbey, where the cook had pretensions of gentility. Georgie resolutely pushed away the memory.
Who has it now? The house, I mean.
I do.
When she looked at him in surprise, Mr. Van Dyvel amended,
"The house is still there, but we never spent more than a few days at a time there. I don't think I've been back more than once since my father died."
"But why? If it's yours, why not go back?"
Mr. Van Dyvel made a resigned gesture.
"Newport has always been more to Mother's taste. She lives to show her jewels and snub the new people."
"Your mother, perhaps, but what about you?"
Georgie cocked her chin.
"Does she know her son likes to mingle with low company, or is that just the prerogative of a gentleman?"
Mr. Van Dyvel interested himself in his toad in the hole.
"She knows I'm stopping a while with friends in London."
Friends. She supposed they might be called that, but it didn't really answer the question.
"Why don't you want to go home?"
Their intimacy only went so far, apparently. Mr. Van Dyvel narrowed his eyes at her.
"Why don't you?"
Georgie picked up her port and lemon, inhaling the familiar acrid scent.
"What, you don't think it's my love of the stage that keeps me at the Ali Baba?"
Mr. Van Dyvel cast her a skeptical look.
"Is this the same woman who told me last week that she's sick of the smell of grease paint?"
Hoist by her own petard.
"You listen too well," grumbled Georgie. "What makes you think I have a home to go to? Most of the girls here don't."
She'd encountered all manner of stories since she'd arrived in London. Stories that made her own troubles seem small and petty in comparison. Brutal stepfathers, starving siblings, mothers out of their minds on gin. There were girls like her, too, who had run off for adventure's sake or because they had a yen for the stage. But her acquaintance in London had opened Georgie's eyes to real want, the sort of want she had never imagined in the security of a rural town.
"Because you're not like the other girls."
Something about the way he said it, about the way he looked at her, made Georgie feel like the lost princess out of a novel. Sarah Crewe and little Lord Fauntleroy rolled into one.
"What about your colonel, the one who raised you?"
Mr. Van Dyvel remembered altogether too much of what she'd told him. Or maybe it was her own fault for succumbing to the temptation of confiding in someone with whom she didn't have to play a role, didn't have to be on guard.
"The colonel died."
So quickly, without warning. He'd gone out for a day's hunting and come home in the back of a wagon, his neck broken going over a fence he'd jumped 1,000 times before.
When the colonel died, a cousin inherited the abbey.
"Not Annabel?"
Mr. Van Dyvel's voice was gentle, unobtrusive. Georgie ran a finger over the jagged edges of the cut pages of the book, feeling the bite of the paper against her skin. She welcomed the pain. It brought her back to herself, grounded her.
Annabel had her portion, but the house was entailed.
Such generosity, everyone had agreed, Mr. Lacey letting his bereaved cousin stay on in her childhood home. Chaperoned, of course, by her companion, Miss Smith. As if the presence of an extra woman in the household was an assurance of propriety.
Was that why you left?
Georgie pressed her lips tightly together.
Let's just say that you have a home to go back to. I don't.
There are homes and homes.
Mr. Van Dyvel traced the rim of his cup with a finger.
My mother has an idea of the man she wants me to be. I'm to marry a Van Rensselaer or a Livingston, occupy the family box at the opera, and begin work on a suitable cottage at Newport. In time I'll have a son who'll do the same. And so it goes.
What's so dreadful about that?
Feeling churlish, Georgie lightened her tone.
I've not met any Van Watsits or Livingstons, so I defer to your judgment in the matter.
The system has its benefits, I suppose. Money, security.
Mr. Van Dyvel moved restlessly in his seat, making an abortive gesture with one hand.
One finds one's escape where one can. My father collected early editions of plays and poetry. It was an eccentricity that could be tolerated, provided he confined his spoils to a glass case in an appropriate room and never allowed it to interfere with the performance of his social obligations.
Georgie was taken aback by the edge of bitterness in his voice.
What's your indulgence, then?
Mr. Van Dyvel paused a moment, thinking. His eyes lifted to her face. Slowly, he said,
Would you believe me if I said you?
Exhilaration warred with alarm. They were friends. She'd no desire for him to make love to her. Why, then, were her hands tingling, her cheeks burning? Georgie gripped her hands together in her lap.
I don't believe I would enjoy being confined to a glass case in an appropriate room. It seems rather limiting.
Mr. Van Dyvel cast her a long, considering look.
You've already broken out of one, haven't you?
Before she could answer, he said,
If you're not averse, I have a proposition for you.
Disappointment came crashing down on her. She ought to have known it would happen sooner or later. It was just that it was later that made it harder. She might have snubbed him with impunity a month ago, but she'd grown accustomed to his face, his company.
What sort of proposition?
Would you come to a play with me?
When she didn't answer, Mr. Van Dyvel said, with a fine air of self-deprecation,
I know it's a bit of a busman's holiday for you, but I've been wanting to see Lady Windermere's fan, and I don't like to go alone.
London, 1894, May. They saw Lady Windermere's fan and Arms and the Man, Georgie's only requirement being that there be no song and dance. Georgie felt decidedly odd on the other side of the looking-glass, sitting in the audience dressed in her best on the arm of a man in evening attire. There were no impediments now to her accompanying Mr. Van Dyvel to the theater in the evening or for a walk in the park in the afternoon. 11 and 1 nights had closed with no promise of a sequel. The doors of the Ali Baba were locked and barred. After 3 weeks, the building already had a look of abandonment about it. The rumor was that it was to be razed, the leasehold sold for a block of flats. In Hyde Park, the trees were brilliant with new leaves, and the grass along the Serpentine was dotted with daisies. Coats were unbuttoned, heavy wools abandoned for lighter fabrics. Children raced ahead of their nannies, rolling hoops and chasing balls, tossing wads of bread to the ducks, who raised their bills from the water. The world had been reborn, and everyone was frolicking. Except for Georgie, who felt as though she had brought winter's pall with her, wrapped around her like a cloak.
Did the audition go well?
Mr. Van Dyvel bent his head to hers as they walked through the arch at Hyde Park Corner, navigating their way through other pedestrians and the steady stream of equestrians bound for Rotten Row. Georgie ducked her head, letting the brim of her unfashionable hat shield her face. The less said about it, the better.
That bad?
To their left, a wild-haired man in a dirty cravat harangued a largely uninterested audience. He might be roaring about anything. Workers' rights, the price of coal, the oncoming apocalypse. But it was spring, and no one was disposed to feel indignant, not with the breeze bringing the scent of new grass and the sun warm on their shoulders. Georgie blinked back sudden tears.
"Worse," she said gruffly.
And it had been worse. So much worse. She'd worn some scanty costumes in her time, yes, but she'd not yet been reduced to dancing in her shimmy. Yet. Mr. Van Dyvel gently squeezed her elbow.
"Something will come along."
Georgie nodded, but couldn't quite trust herself to speak. Nothing had come along. The burlesques were closing, one by one, replaced by musical comedies featuring a different class of actress, with more emphasis on the singing and less on the legs. Her voice might be good enough for the Alibaba, but it wouldn't fly at the Gaiety. She'd thought she couldn't sink lower, but it seemed that there was nowhere to go but down.
"I've been thinking of a change of profession," she managed as they strolled with the rest of humanity onto the footpath that ran between the Serpentine and the Row. "There's an opening at the ribbon counter at Liberty's."
"You would work as a shop girl?"
"Is it any more shameful than showing my legs for money?"
The words came out more sharply than Georgie had intended. She tried to soften her tone.
"I thought Americans were all for industry and hard work. You've a profession, after all."
"If I ever practice it."
Mr. Van Dyvel bent to retrieve a fallen doll, handing it back to the small child with a bow and a smile. Straightening, he grimaced at Georgie.
"We'll see how much longer I can contrive to escape it."
Georgie felt a heaviness in her chest.
"Do you return to New York soon?"
"Sooner than I would like."
Mr. Van Dyvel scuffed a well-polished shoe against the dirt of the path.
"My mother writes me that my sister is all but engaged."
"Felicitations," said Georgie, her voice unnatural to her ears. "When may the happy union be expected?"
"Soon. As to the happiness of it..."
Mr. Van Dyvel shrugged his shoulders. Beneath his tall hat, his hair gleamed golden in the spring sunlight. Georgie felt herself memorizing him, the way the light and shadow played across his clean-shaven face, the way he moved, the way he walked, all the little details that made him so peculiarly himself, and over the last 2 months, inexplicably dear. She could feel herself pressing the details into memory, saving them like dried flowers kept in a spinster's chest, relics of a past that might have been, of a future that never was.
"Do you not approve your sister's choice, then?"
She tried to keep her voice light, her tone neutral. Mr. Van Dyvel's sister should be nothing to her, her marriage none of Georgie's concern. Because Georgie was nothing to Mr. Van Dyvel, she knew that, had always known that their time was limited, that his real life would inevitably close back around him. She could feel it happening already, in the influx of wealthy Americans to London for the season, in the evenings that she dined alone at the Feathers because Mr. Van Dyvel was, as he put it, doing his duty by his mother's friends.
"I know Teddy Newland a little."
Mr. Van Dyvel paused by the railing that separated the equestrians from the pedestrians.
"He's exactly what my mother had hoped for. Standing, breeding, money."
"And your sister? What does she hope for?"
"My sister?"
"It is her marriage," Georgie pointed out dryly. "Surely she has some say."
"If you can think that, you haven't met my mother."
Mr. Van Dyvel rubbed a hand against his temple.
I don't know what my sister wants. To have a household of her own, I presume. It hasn't been easy for her in my mother's house. Sometimes I wonder if I should have stood up for her more, at least made sure she could read a book without hiding it under her pillow. But if I intervened, who knew what might happen? It might only make things worse. No books under the pillow, no books at all.
Mr. Van Dyvel grimaced.
Teddy should be good for that, at least. He won't care what she reads, so long as she looks right in public.
You sound less than pleased for her.
Do I?
Mr. Van Dyvel glanced down at her, and she found herself struck, as always, by the warmth in those blue eyes, the honesty.
I suppose it's because I see in it my own fate, and I find it a decidedly lowering prospect.
Standing, breeding, and money?
Georgie teased.
Poor stuff indeed.
It is when there's no meeting of minds.
His voice was low. It seemed to resonate through her with the pounding of the horse's hooves.
I don't want to see my wife once a week at the opera and pass messages through the servants in the between.
Georgie dropped her eyes before the expression in his.
That's the problem with fate, isn't it?
She said, starting to walk again, speaking rapidly just to cover the silence.
It has a way of catching up with you. You've overstayed your time here as it is.
Have I?
Mr. Van Dyvel caught up to her easily, his shadow covering hers, subsuming it.
I feel as though I could live a lifetime in London and still only know the part of it.
Georgie glanced back at him over her shoulder.
Don't go looking too hard. There are dark corners you'd do well to avoid.
There are dark corners in any city.
Don't forget the dark corners in our hearts, said Georgie mockingly.
Those two, said Mr. Van Dyvel, so seriously that Georgie stopped by the rail to peer up at him. Would you believe me?
Yes.
There was something about the way he was looking at her, the indecision, the earnestness, that made Georgie's chest feel tight. Mr. Van Dyvel cleared his throat and said unevenly,
Would you believe me if I told you I found more to admire in a dark theater than a well-lit ballroom?
It wasn't what he had originally intended to say. The leaves of the trees glittered through a fine haze of unshed tears as Georgie shook her head.
You might think that now, but you'd regret it by and by.
The brim of his hat lent an extra intimacy as he bent towards her, as though it were only the two of them in that little spot of shadow.
There are many things I regret, he said. But meeting you isn't one of them.
Under the cover of the chattering crowds, his gloved hand found hers. Georgie could feel the shock of it, of his fingers twining with hers. Such a small gesture, and yet so strangely intimate. She should pull her hand away, she knew, say something frivolous, something silly. But the words tangled on her tongue, and she found she could only stare up at him, naked and bare in her despair, all her emotions written on her face for anyone to see. What a fool she had been, what a preening fool to imagine she could keep her heart in all diligence, that she was proof against love. She'd fancied herself in love before. The memory of it left a sour taste in the back of her throat. She'd fallen into infatuation with a set of regimentals and a fine mustache, bragging tales of daring and a showy hand with a whip. There was nothing the least bit showy about Mr. Van Dyvel, and that was just the danger of it. Slowly, insensibly, she had slipped into love with him, stroll by stroll, conversation by conversation, until she found herself sunk so deep she couldn't muster the simple power to free her fingers from his. Georgie could feel all her hard-won pride crumbled into dust. The fact of it terrified her beyond measure. Helplessly, Georgie said,
"Mr. Van Dyvel."
His fingers tightened briefly on hers.
It would give me great pleasure, he said gravely, if you could bring yourself to call me Bay.
Bay, she echoed, and the very sound of it on her lips shamed her.